Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette. Welcome to Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'll be talking to Professor John Hardwick, Chairman of the Department of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University, and our topic will be The Duty to Die. This show is part of a two-part series on the topic, The Duty to Die. In this show, Professor Hardwick will explain his views on the question. In the next show, Nat Hentoff, the syndicated columnist, will respond to Professor Hardwick much in the way that he did during the recent debate on the ETSU campus. Professor Hardwick has argued in written work that individuals under certain circumstances might have a duty to die, and that idea is undoubtedly very foreign to many people and perhaps morally repugnant. The attempt in this show is to have him to explain that view. Unfortunately, the first minute of the program was lost due to technical difficulties. So I'll begin by phrasing the question I put to Professor Hardwick during the interview and the beginning of his answer, of his first answer. Professor Hardwick, we want to explain exactly what you mean by the duty to die, and in particular the circumstances under which such a duty might arise. Professor Hardwick responded that a duty to die, what he meant by a duty to die, was a self-understood, self-imposed, and self-enforced duty, a duty to die that might arise under particular circumstances because of certain obligations to the individual's family. And what he is trying to do in the first question is to explain the nature of the obligations to the family and the circumstances under which an individual might actually have a duty to die. He begins by citing the circumstances, in particular, the responsibilities we have to our loved ones. These responsibilities arise primarily because of two circumstances, one concerning finances, the second concerning the obligation to care.
Imposed on families by a serious or chronic illness, and the second have to do with caregiving burdens. Okay, the first one, in the debate, I used the following example. An 85-year-old woman dying of congestive heart failure. She was alert, assertive, very much wanted to live. Her doctors gave her only a 50% chance to live six more months, but she beat the odds and lived two more years before she died. Her doctors, focusing only on this woman and her health, consider this a tremendous medical success. But think about what does this treatment mean to her family. Her family in this case consisted of only one daughter, 55 years old, and this daughter cared for her mother, but before her mother died, this woman, the younger woman, her daughter, had lost her job, her career, her house, and all of her savings. So that shows you what kind of burdens, financial burdens, families can be put on. The daughter's future, her whole future, has been radically altered by her mother's illness. She does not have time to recoup her savings. Her retirement plans have been devastated. She's going to have to start all over again with a different job and a different line of work, so on. The rest of her life has been affected. Okay, the other kind of case comes up when family members require extensive caregiving, and especially over long periods of time. Perhaps the classic case there is Alzheimer's. Caregivers, when they have no relief, when they are single caregivers, sole caregivers, are just devastated. They essentially have no life of their own. They have no time to have a life of their own, no energy to have a life of their own. This kind of caregiving can take 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. These people become exhausted. Friendships disappear as they have no time to devote to their friends. Life plans are disrupted. Not surprisingly, these people lose all hope. They often lose all sense of who they are. They become profoundly depressed, and in the end, even their health is compromised.
Okay.
Now, you could add a third category if you want, And that has to do with not just the caregiver himself or herself, but what that means for the rest of the family. So you imagine a family, and the mother, it's usually a woman who delivers the care, and the mother in the family is spending all of her time taking care of her seriously ill father. That means her children are neglected, and they grew up essentially without the care of their mother. So though the children don't provide care, they are burdened too by the care that's given.
Okay. So those would be the circumstances under which someone might think they have a duty to die. Now, in giving your argument for the duty to die, you talk about two primary points of the argument. I wonder if you could briefly explain what those two points are, and then we'll go back and look at each of them in turn.
Okay, the first has to do with the way our medical technology is changing death. Used to be, just 50 years ago, prior to World War II, before there were effective widespread antibiotics and respirators were not yet in wide use, people who got seriously enough ill so that they were bedridden would, before too long, develop a pneumonia, usually. And since the pneumonia could not be effectively treated, these people died within a short period of time. What's happened is we have come a long, long way in treating serious illnesses and in staving off death. But the very success of those treatments gives us a whole new series of problems, ethical problems and social problems, as we can prolong the lives of seriously, seriously ill people for longer and longer periods of time.
Okay, so in essence, we're facing moral problems we just didn't face in the past.
That's right, and those moral problems are the result of the successes of our medical technology. We're all very, very glad that people don't drop dead of heart attacks the way they used to. We're very glad that people don't die of pneumonia every time they get sick for a month. We're very glad that AIDS can be treated longer, and so on. But these successful treatments have moral costs, okay, and emotional costs.
And so you're certainly not opposed to the treatments.
No.
You're simply saying it creates new problems we didn't have before.
And in that sense, we're all victims to the medical technology, because it gives us choices we didn't have before. And so our moral situation is changed by the technology we've created. But it's great technology. We're all glad to have it. We're all glad that we don't face death by pneumonia as soon as we get seriously ill. I know I am.
Okay. So changes in technology create new moral questions. Now, there's a second element of your argument, which you take to be especially important in how we ought to think about the new problems that we now face. Could you explain what that is?
And that is, my basic vision is that we are connected to others. And when we think about death, when we have thought about death and dying and illness, we thought about that as if the only person affected were the person who were sick, the person who is dying. Whose life is it anyway? We ask rhetorically. And the answer to that question is, it's only the life of the patient that counts here. And that's that focus on the individual, separated from her connections to others, has given rise to a bioethics of autonomy. Let the patient decide. After all, it's her life, it's her body, it's her health, it's her life. But that's too simple, because we are connected. Because we are connected, the treatment decisions that are made for and on behalf of chronically ill people or dying people often affect the lives not only of them, but of their loved ones and family. So if you go back to the example of the woman, the example we started with, the example of the woman with congestive heart failure, if you look not just at the moment where she's dying, but you look at her whole life versus her daughter's whole life, the daughter's life was clearly more affected as a whole than the dying mother's life was. So it isn't even true that my illness and death affects me more than it affects the lives of my loved ones and family.
Could you fill that out? You said that take it what you had in mind, was that the prolonging of the 85-year-old woman's life for 2 years did affect her life, but the extent and the quality of the way in which it affected it was not as great as the extent and the quality of the way in which it negatively impacted the daughter. Is that correct?
That's correct. Think about it in terms of burdens, if you will, and which burdens are heavier, which burdens you would most hope to avoid. Now, no question about it, the 85-year-old mother got two extra years that she might not have had. And although she was seriously ill and she ended up bedridden and on oxygen and so on, those were years that she wanted. She thought her quality of life was okay, was worth the candle. The game was worth the candle. However, when you compare the two, which is worse, to lose a 50% chance of 6 more months of life, or even to lose 2 more years of life at age 85, or to lose your job, your career, your home, and all your savings at age 55. Now, if we ask ourselves, which is the greater burden? Which is the burden that we really hope we don't face in life? If we have to face one of those two, I think the choice for most people is obvious. I'd rather forego 2 years at age 85 than to lose my job, my career, my home, and all my savings at age 55. I think almost all of us would make that choice.
Okay. Now, in this, the explanation you just gave almost helps explain why it seems to me to go a bit beyond just the claim that we're connected, that it helps explain why I, as an individual, might be rationally more concerned to make sure that I don't face the complete loss of all my savings, the complete loss of my career, et cetera, at the age of 55, than I would be to ensure that I could prolong my life for 2 years at the age of 85. But I take it to the claim about connection is even stronger than that. It's that if I care about my family, then what I do not want to do is to put them in a position where they're likely to lose their life savings in order to care for me. Where they're likely to have to give up their lives to care for me. Is that an important element of...
That's critical. If you don't care about what happens to your children at all, then you won't care about whether they lose their job and career and their whole life at age 55. Families get stuck. There's not very much that they can do. If mother is discharged from the hospital in a certain condition and she needs care, you can't just put her in the back room and ignore her, not if you care for her. So the care has to go both ways, I think. Care has to be a two-way street. Families do have responsibilities to care for sick members of their family. There's nothing in my idea that denies that at all. But the care has to go the other way, too. Just because you're sick and your life isn't so good and you need a lot of help doesn't free you from needing to care about your family and how their lives are going, too, and what your treatment means for them and their lives.
Okay. Well, I want to explore these ideas in further detail in the second half of the show. Let me just pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may be tuning in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is John Hardwick, Chair of the Department of Philosophy at ETSU, and we're discussing the duty to die. You've given a nice outline of what your position is. I can imagine, though, that listeners would have serious misgivings about the position as you describe it. It may be they just think it's a bit unusual, they may think it's odd, or they may think it's morally perverse. And some of the things I can imagine a listener wanting to ask you, and so I'll ask them for you, is, first of all, how common are the sorts of cases that you've mentioned? I mean, is this something which regularly happens, or is it relatively rare? Because if it's relatively rare, maybe it's something we don't need to worry about. Whereas if it's more common and getting increasingly common, then we do.
It is common. It's very common. The scenario of the woman losing her job, at least, and all of her savings happens literally thousands of times each year in the United States. Moreover, it's likely to get increasingly common, and it's going to get increasingly common for two reasons. The first one is that our medical technology is bound to improve. It's almost sure to improve, and by improve, we draw the same two-edged sword that I was talking about. Suppose we could treat Alzheimer's victims much better than we can now, and we could prolong the life, slow down the progress of Alzheimer's to the point where people live 20 or 25 years between the time when they were diagnosed with Alzheimer's and the time they died. That would be great. Everybody would be in favor of that. But suppose what that meant is for the last 15 or 20 years of that, you didn't recognize your spouse, you were incapable of giving love, and so on. Then for the Alzheimer's victim, it might be a very good thing, but for the families of Alzheimer's victims, that would be horrible. The burdens of round-the-clock, seven-day-a-week care would go on for decades instead of only for 5 or 8 years. That's the first reason. The technology is going to continue to progress. The second reason is we're really running into a cost barrier. The new and better treatments are rarely cheaper than the old treatments. They're better, but they're more expensive. And we're simply running into the limits of our ability to provide the care through institutional means that everybody wants and needs. That's a problem not of our healthcare system, it's a problem all over the world, and it's generated by the technology, the improving technology. But when healthcare systems are under siege because they don't have enough money to do everything they would like to do, there is a tremendous temptation on the part of healthcare systems to externalize the costs. And what that means is if the healthcare system can shift the burdens of care onto families, then that's care the system doesn't have to provide, and that saves money to give the care to other patients. And in a way, that's a good thing, because there are other patients that need the care. But as we discharge patients from hospitals quicker and sicker, as the phrase goes, more and more burdens of care get shifted onto families. And that's a second feature that's going to make duty to die more and more common as we progress.
Okay. I can imagine, though, someone saying, now, wait a moment, Professor Hardwig. It seems as if you're putting a monetary value on human life, that you're telling us, okay, families ought to be willing to fork out $10,000 to save Gramps. But if it gets to be $25,000 or $40,000 or $50,000, they shouldn't. And it's as if we're putting a monetary value on human life. Is that a consequence of your decision, of your view?
First of all, we always put a value, monetary value, on human life. If we were absolutely trying to save every last person we could save on the highways, for example, cars would look like tanks, and they would cost $500,000 a piece, and the speed limits would probably be 35 miles an hour, and no one would die in an automobile accident. But the social costs are too great for that. I think it's very, very contextual. Sometimes even $10,000 to prolong the life of Gramps is too much. If you're a poor family, if you're literally struggling to pay the bills, to pay the rent, to keep clothes on people's back, if the kids are hungry anyway, then $10,000 may be too much to spend for the life of Grant. On the other hand, if you've got lots of money, if you're wealthy, there may be no cost that would justify not prolonging the life of Gramps. That's one thing. But when you talk about putting a monetary value on life, you need to recognize that we're not normally just talking about money. back to the example of the 85-year-old with her 55-year-old daughter, it's not just that the daughter's lost money. She has lost much besides. Her future is radically uncertain. Even her health care won't be as good. So we're talking, often when we're talking about dollars, we really are talking about what somebody's life is like. That's why money is important. So it may seem like I'm putting a monetary value on life, but I don't think I am in any sense that we don't always have to do that anyway. But the second point, we shouldn't get too focused on money. Back to the example we started with of the Alzheimer's victim. In the case of Alzheimer's victims, the burdens are the burdens of caregiving. The financial burdens are not necessarily so great. Alzheimer's victims may need very little medical care, and it's low-tech medical care that they often need, so the financial burdens of Alzheimer's are not heavy. The caregiving burdens, however, are staggering.
Okay. Could society step in and effectively eliminate the duty to die? For example, you said that for some people perhaps $10,000 is too much to pay to keep Gramps alive. And you said that providing caregiving for the husband who has Alzheimer may be too draining on the wife. But of course we could, at least it seems as if we might, be able to get around those problems by simply saying that a society will pay the $10,000 for the caregiving, and society will pay to have, if not a full-time caregiver for the person with Alzheimer's, at least to pay some money for a relief caregiver. Now, would that be an option, and if so, would that eliminate what you take the duty to die to be?
For right now, that is an option. That is something our society could afford to do. What we could decide to do is that we Americans will pay for all the care, both medical care and other kinds of care, that anyone needs, any American needs who is unable to care for himself or herself. Now, we could do that right now, and that would virtually eliminate a duty to die. You might still have duties to your loved ones. You might still have duties to go into a care center, though you would rather be cared for at home, because it's too hard on your family to care for you at home, and you don't like the care center as well, but that's still what you ought to do. But it wouldn't be a duty to die at that point.
But we could do that. It would be analogous to the duty to die. It would be a duty to choose something you'd prefer not to choose because it would be to the benefit of your family.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. That would work for the short run. I don't know whether it'll work for the long run. Right now, it's possible to spend $250,000 on an increasing array of deaths. But clearly, we couldn't afford, or could we afford? I don't think we could afford to spend $250,000 on everybody's death. Even if we had the technology to do that, we couldn't afford that technology. And if you think we could afford $250,000 on everybody's death, could we afford $500,000 on everybody's death? I don't think so. In the end, somebody's got to pay for this, and if everybody's death costs $200,000, then I've got to pay for mine and you got to pay for yours. That's a lot of money. I don't think in the long run, as technology continues to improve, society could bear the expense and thereby eliminate a duty to die. I lost my thought here. Well, let's just leave it at that.
Okay. Let me raise one other objection, which I've certainly heard people have to your views, and it's what's sometimes referred to as a slippery slope argument, that what your view is tantamount to doing is to saying that some lives are not worth living, that there are certain circumstances in which it's okay for someone to decide, at least in their own case, that their life is not worth living, and to take steps, if necessary, to end it. Such a view, these people say, lessens the prohibitions against taking life and could ultimately lead to something like what happened in the German Holocaust, a complete disregard for individuals' life, a willingness to take the lives of people that we happen to think don't match our account of a life worth living. Is this a serious danger? Do you see this as counting against your view?
It is, to some extent, a danger. I don't think it's very real in our present context. I don't think we're moving in that direction. Now, there's some places you can stop to keep the slope from being so slippery. A duty to die can only apply, as I see it, to competent adults. A duty to die must be self-recognized, self-imposed, and self-enforced. That means I can't go around deciding that you or someone else who can't speak for herself has a duty to die. A duty to die, a moral duty to die, can only be self-imposed. And that means I'm not talking about a policy of euthanasia or a policy of physician-assisted suicide or any policy that decides that someone else's life is not worth living. In fact, I'm trying to talk about lives that definitely are worth living. That's what makes the decision so hard, and that's what makes the situation so tragic. If we really thought that the life of the woman with congestive heart failure or the Alzheimer's victim was not worth living, then it would be a simple matter. We would feel no reason, there would be no reason for us to feel moral anguish and so on. Now, here's the sense in which the slope is a little slippery, however. I don't think there can be a duty to die for people who are unable to speak for themselves. However, I think we need to start thinking seriously about what are we going to do, what are we doing to families, what are we doing to the other lives that are connected to this patient's lives. I think in neonatal intensive care units, for example, the only issue is not what's best for this baby. I think the issue is much more complex than that. It's got to do with what is it going to do to the siblings and the parents of this baby if we prolong this life. Similarly, there was a horrible case not too long ago of an accident, closed head injury. The woman who was in that accident will never recognize herself, will never be able to live any kind of meaningful life. However, there's no reason why she can't live 40 more years. Well, her parents and her husband are planning to take care of her right now. They're planning to rotate around the clock, 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, you go to work for 8 hours, and then you take care of your daughter or your wife for 8 hours, and then you sleep for 8 hours, and you can see these people aren't going to have any life for the next 40 years. So I think we need to think about what we're doing to all kinds of lives when we save somebody like that. That's the sense in which the slope is somewhat slippery, if you want. But I think those are legitimate questions.
Okay. You want to wrap up in 15 seconds, if you want to try to summarize what your message would be to the listener.
The message is to be ready, to be prepared, to think about what you're going to end up. All of us are going to end up with serious illnesses. We're all going to die. Whether or not we have a duty to die, we're all going to die. So be ready and think about what your decisions are going to mean, not only for yourself, but for your loved ones. That's the loving, caring, responsible thing to do.
Okay, thank you very much for appearing in the show.
Thank you.
Been talking today with John Hardwick, professor in the Department of Philosophy at ETSU, and we've been discussing the duty to die. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.